The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly digest of the best in architecture, craft, fonts and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. This week, how is the Made in Britain brand faring? From furniture to fashion and textiles, we meet the folk colouring the manner in which design from the UK is seen around the world.
The Windsor chair is a format that evolved very incrementally with lots of clever innovation around structure and affordability over probably, well, since the Middle Ages. And it's those ideas, those building blocks of a chair, that I felt should be something that should be revisited.
We grab a seat with the furniture maker who's lending a contemporary twist to the age-old Windsor chair. And
Liberty was very good at keeping all their designs. We've got the most amazing collection of pattern books, huge, big pattern books. Go right back to the beginning of Liberty's textile production.
We rummage through the drawers at the textile archives of one of London's oldest department stores, Liberty. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. First up, some good news for British furniture design. While the UK boasts luminaries such as Sir Kenneth Grange, David Meller and Jasper Morrison, Britain's design clout still lags behind that of Italy and Scandinavia in terms of global appeal. British furniture firm Goodfield, however, is moving into the market with a seemly new take on seating. Set up 3 years ago, the firm creates a timber-made turn on the age-old Windsor chair, plus tables to boot. Keen to find out more, I pulled up a chair of my own with the brand's founder and designer, Max Gutfield.
It really came about from a conversation with another designer and both of our desire to sort of rediscover English types in furniture making and design. I would say over the last 100 years, there's been a movement into a more sort of international design atmosphere, and I guess it was an attempt to be relevant in terms of modern design sensibility, but also to tap back into the uniquely English heritage in furniture making, which it seemed there'd been a little bit of an absence of.
I'm quite interested in your background. What was your education? Were you trained as a furniture maker? Was it something you always knew that you were going to do? And did you always know you're going to do your own thing and not work for someone else?
In terms of my entry into furniture, my dad and I used to have a furniture retail business when I was a kid. And I actually grew up in the Chiltern Hills, which were once the place famous for furniture making. High Wycombe had been the centre of furniture making up until about 100 years ago. So although I hadn't consciously set out to end up in furniture, I think there were influences around where I grew up. And obviously just the family background as well. So it was a number of different things permeating. And from a practical point of view, I was going out on weekends restoring furniture for my dad's business. And those skills, you've spent a lot of time around other people's work. And it eventually became quite frustrating not being able to create my own.
Tell us a little bit, for the uninitiated, if you will, what there is to know about the English chair-making tradition. People may be familiar with the Windsor, but, you know, what was the gap that you saw and how far had that, you know, that chair-making lineage come when you first interacted with it and first became aware of it?
I suppose there's a point at which British designers became very influenced by what was going on in America and Italy and around the rest of the world, probably from the 50s onwards in Scandinavia. And it's a great time for design. It's probably the high point in furniture design. But corresponding with that is also a really sort of international atmosphere. And part of that inevitably meant slightly losing sight of one's origins in one's own history in furniture. And the Windsor chair is a format that evolved very incrementally with lots of clever innovation around structure and affordability over probably, well, since the Middle Ages. And it's those ideas, those building blocks of a chair, that I felt should be something that should be revisited. So coming to this whenever it was 3-4 years ago, I was looking around and seeing Windsor chairs which didn't necessarily have anything new to offer. And, or for me, you know, it's a very subjective thing, but I thought it was now a time that we could breathe new life into this English tradition.
Provenance is vital, and knowing where things come from. How did your chair go from a sketch on a piece of paper to a thing in a room, an object that you can sit on, a machine for living?
Well, as anybody who could probably tell you who's put a sketch into an actual object and made that transition, there are lots of prototypes and more, you know, with your first designs. So the first chair probably took around a year to get from concept to a real sort of living, breathing object. It's a much kind of more refined process now, but it's costly. And even if your design is fully realised to the best of your intentions, you still have no guarantee it's going to be popular with other people, or it's going to sell, or it's hitting that sort of mark in a consumer's mind. So it's an inherently risky business, but you hope with the better able you are to create multiple products and respond to different areas of the market with different kinds of furniture, you have a better chance of having success in a consumer's mind as well.
There would have been avenues you could have pursued where you maybe could have got the chair manufactured somewhere else with a little less oversight over the production of it, with a little less transparency of the materials used, the wages of the craftsmen, say. How important was it for it to be made in the UK, and how did you, I'm thinking maybe of budding young furniture designers with a sketch on a piece of paper who are thinking about how they get their product off the ground and into a workshop. How did you find the place to build them, and how did you settle on the fact that it would be in the UK?
Well, you're right. I mean, a lot of people will, even brands that we associate as being British, will outsource a lot of their production abroad. And one reason for that isn't just the cost, it's actually the quality of production. There are people in Portugal and Estonia and Eastern Europe who can produce, you know, incredibly well and on time. So as well as the cost issue, what one can encounter with production in the UK is that there aren't many people. They can be quite snowed under with other orders, and their workflows can be quite sporadic and unpredictable. But yeah, it was a priority for us making in the UK, and it was a priority using English timber as well. Part of it is that connection with the woodland, which was the home of the bodger, the man who turned on the lathe. And it's that contact with the environment that for me was quite important. So even though we're working with modern production methods, there's a sense of it being rooted here, which it would be very easy to manufacture in the same woods in Portugal. But for me, that really did require an authenticity that we were able to make here from English timber and be seen and actually be genuinely in that legacy of English furniture making.
And the radio is a wonderful thing for talking about your motivations. It's a wonderful thing to eke away at, you know, your entrepreneurial journey. What it's terrible for is giving people a sense of what the furniture actually looks like. So I'm going to set you a tough task. Would you tell us a little bit about your current collection, the shapes, the sort of the visual language that went into it?
Two of the pieces I would define as being classically Windsor style. And in essence, it's a very difficult thing to nail in a sentence. But a Windsor chair is a chair whose seat is the primary structure of the chair. So a thick seat provides the structural centre for all the different intersecting elements. So the stretchers and the backrest, they all anchor into a strong seat. So without necessarily knowing that or acknowledging that, most people, when they look at a Windsor chair, will recognise one when they see one. So two of the chairs, the Stout chair, which was designed by Peter Cathsides with me, where that came from, we wanted a bigger, more robust chair. A lot of chairs getting very, very small and petite. And we wanted something that wasn't too self-conscious and felt in that country tradition. So in our early discussions, I guess we thought about what were these quintessential English ideas. And one was the value of the good old-fashioned English boozer. In terms of the range, we started with Stout, which was influenced by the love of English beer. The chair, it's a simple scooped seat, a wide seat and deep. And we didn't want to emulate other designers in making things much smaller. Everything seemed to be getting smaller and smaller. And with the Stout, we wanted to do something with slightly larger than normal proportions. It's a mixture of elm and ash is the kind of showcase piece. Elm has become a very difficult wood to get hold of. It only grows in the north of England because of the spread of I think it's Dutch elm disease mainly. The Frank chair, which was my first design, was based on a European format of chair, which is a fisherman's chair or country chair. And these are rush seated, and essentially they have two sidebars or stretchers at each side, two backrests, and it's a simple wooden structure. And there are lots of elegant Italian examples of this chair, and you see them all around coastal regions in northern Italy. And I guess post-Brexit, it seemed like maybe we could take a couple of lessons from our European neighbours and come up with an English take on this. So it ends up looking like quite a humble interpretation of this European tradition. So it's much less poised and fine than your Italian equivalent, but hopefully it has something uniquely English to offer, simplicity and humility.
I sense that the hard work for you kind of starts now, because it's about getting the product out there as well. How do you intend to get these chairs in places, in front of people? Would the ideal situation be a big contract buy where restaurants buy them in and they become the showpieces of a wonderful dining room? Or is it about making a point about English design, do you think? Is it about selling, or is it a philosophical venture?
It is about selling. I think you have to do these things in stages. So it's a really humble range at the moment. There's three chairs and a few tables, essentially. We've already signed up designers for next pieces, including some really interesting people like Adam Furman, who's a big name in architecture and design at the moment. But yes, it is about getting it out there. And that is the problem that confronts any budding designer or budding entrepreneur interested in furniture making, because the retail environment in the UK isn't fantastic. You have a few choice design showrooms in London. And in terms of national retailers, there are shops like John Lewis. There is Heels, but again, that's predominantly London. So it's a really limited selection of retailers that a lot of talented, you know, incredible designers are chasing after. So part of it has inevitably to be exhibiting at shows, to be focusing on the website, and, you know, social media will be a great help as well. At the moment, we just have a small by appointment studio in North London. And for us, I would suppose in the high end, you know, where you really want to be is in West London and more central. I think it has to be approached in stages. Eventually, it would be a wonderful thing to be able to have a retail presence.
Max Gutfield, founder of British furniture maker Goodfield, speaking to me a little earlier. Now for a quick aside. Few countries amass the talents of the UK when it comes to design. The list is ever so long. Zaha Hadid, Amanda Levitt, Richard Rogers, Norman Foster, Nicholas Grimshaw and David Chipperfield. And on it goes. Now, while many designs from around the world are given forms by the hand of British talent, they're often destined to be built beyond British shores. But it's worth considering the relative expense of manufacturing in the UK as a barrier to the latest batch of British studios, architects and industrial designers. While it's still possible to make things in Italy and Portugal, and flash commissions gravitate to the Gulf, China and cities with newly minted wealth, it's worth tempering optimism about British design with a few plans about keeping manufacturing alive and well on its shores. The metaphorical Monocle on Design mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Daphne Karnesis. She can be contacted at dk@monocle.com. This is Monocle on Design. Stay tuned. Just off London's Regent Street is a madcap black and white Tudor revival affair, the name of which has long been synonymous with textile design. Liberty prints, those colourful and complex patterns and floral prints, adorn everything from lamps to furniture upholstery and are also a mainstay in global fashion. They've been snapped up in previous years by the likes of Swedish firm Acne, as well as more mainstream brands including Yves Saint Laurent and Vivienne Westwood. Each piece of every fabric ever made during the company's long history is still kept in an archive, which an in-house team of designers tweaks for the modern day and releases in collections twice a year. Journalist par excellence and sometime researcher of this show, Daphne Karnesis, took a peek inside the private archive with head Anna Baruma to find out how inspiration often springs from time-tested designs.
My name is Anna Baruma and I look after the textile archive at Liberty. We're in the what used to be the director's dining room in the Liberty shop, and it's done up as a sort of a very small Tudor hall, but with a very grand fireplace.
And can you take me through a typical day? What do you do?
Well, there is no typical day, but I'm lucky enough to sit have a desk in the studio. So we have a building behind the shop, which is where all the offices are, but that's where the design studio is, and that's where the scarves are designed, the bags, but also the fabrics. I'm lucky enough to sit in the studio and listen to what's happening with the designers. I also have another room in that same building, which is set up as a sort of small archive room. The textile archive at Liberty is huge and is no longer stored in London. It was too big. So we just got the best of in that small room. And that's where I see wholesale customers, researchers, the designers. It's an enormous archive because we produce two collections of textiles each year, but we do keep a piece of each fabric. Liberty's textile archive is not open to the public, so no young designers, I'm afraid, have access to it. We have another archive, which is the sort of historic archive and is absolutely amazing, is on permanent loan to Westminster Archives. And anybody can go there and look at all these fantastic old mail order catalogues, records, photographs, everything to do with the business, except for the textiles.
So what sort of people are allowed to go into the archive with you?
Our textile business is a wholesale business, and so very special customers who commit to doing some sort of bespoke design will also get access.
And where do these designs come from that you have in your archive? I know that some of them are anonymous, so you don't even know the genesis of them, and others aren't.
So the majority are anonymous because Liberty was very good at keeping all their designs. We've got the most amazing collection of pattern books, huge, big pattern books, go right back to the beginning of Liberty's textile production. But they weren't interested in the history of it. They were interested in it for the design. So they didn't keep the records. So not until the 1950s do I have a much better idea of where these designs came from. There are the sort of odd instances before then that we know. There's a fantastic 1930s book which actually has most of the designers' names in it, although sometimes only by their initials. And so sometimes we just don't know who's designed them. And one of the most prolific designers in the 1930s, whose designs still appear on Liberty's classic Tana lawns, was known by the initials DS. And there's only one name that pops up that has the same initials and who does a similar sort of design. And so I think it's somebody called Mrs. D. Stoneley, but I cannot say that for sure.
Guess we'll never know. Maybe we can talk about some other sort of prolific designers that maybe Liberty is most known for. How about William Morris, for example?
Well, so William Morris was a competitor. He never designed for Liberty. He had his own shop, was very successful. He didn't need Liberty. Liberty was also very successful, didn't need William Morris, I don't think. But there is a definite sort of arts and crafts feel to some of the designs in the early days, and so they were obviously all looking at each other. Morris and Company closed in 1940, and after that, the blocks were at various companies like Sanderson and Steads up in Carlisle. At some point, I don't know exactly when, the directors of these three companies made some sort of gentleman's agreement that each company would use certain designs.
And do you still acquire some designs, or do you now use the archive and in-house designers?
So most of the designs are designed in-house, either some of them completely to do with the theme of that particular collection, or because they've looked at the archive and they've been inspired by it, or they've taken an archive design and perhaps brought it up to date and put it in there, and it, so it's slightly altered. But there are occasional collaborations. We've not done quite so many in the last couple of years, but before that we've definitely got people, either people who have some sort of design background to come in and choose designs from the archive, like Florence Welch came in once and chose some archive designs, which were then again brought up to date and put into the collection. Or we did a collaboration where we had artists like Grayson Perry. He came to the archive, he looked at it and he put it into his head, and then he came up with his own designs. But it's very interesting. They're absolutely Grace and Perry, but there is something about them that he's obviously understood very exactly what Liberty is about.
You just mentioned this process of bringing the designs up to date. What exactly do you mean by that?
By bringing them up to date, you change the colouring, you perhaps change the scale, you perhaps get rid of certain elements, put other ones in. There are all sorts of ways of doing that.
And Liberty's is very much a British company. How does that, for someone who might not have seen Liberty's products and prints and fabrics, how does that for you manifest itself?
Well, I'm not British myself. I'm from Holland. There's one thing that I think is really interesting when you look at British design, on textiles anyway. There's so much with flowers, and I think that is particularly British. I mean, if you go back to the 16th century, it's in all these clothes are embroidered with flowers, and I think that we still do that today.
Your dress has some flowers on, very fittingly.
Liberty print on.
And Anna, you mentioned earlier that you've been here with Liberty doing this job for around 20 years now. What's your background and what led you into this?
Oh, I have a very strange background to end up here. I started off as a designer, a theatrical designer, but then at some point in my life I changed and I did an MA art history. And one of my tutors, who is a textile historian and also had been a textile archivist, said, "You are an archivist." And she got me this job. So I was just very, very lucky.
She spotted that talent in me, that spark. Where did you study?
At the Courtauld.
So where are we heading now, Anna?
So now we're going to go into the other building. Okay. Still, we're backstage now, okay. In the Tudor building. Mm-hmm. This has been done up to look a little bit like an archive.
Some really beautiful furniture.
Lovely furniture. A very old cutting table from the shop. The furniture done up in Liberty Furnishing Textiles. At the moment, we've got Arthur's chair there. It's not going to stay.
Arthur Liberty.
Arthur Liberty's own chair. I thought I'd just show you three designs that are very much from the archive, but have been altered. And they're on the Silk Collection of 2019. It's a landscape print, but actually in between in sort of paisley borders. So it's got all these elements that Liberty was famous for. It's got that sort of paisley look that is one of another key design element in Liberty fabrics. It's got the flowers or the trees, but in a very 60s take on Art Deco, I think. Bernard Neville was one of the people who did bring back these landscape prints. He told me once that he designed things so that fashion designers could only use the fabrics in certain ways. And so this is obviously one-directional, a border print. So you can only use it in a way that Bernard Neville thinks is necessary. Now, what the designers have looked at all this. I have most of the designs that Liberty has ever done digitized on the computer. And so they've got access to that. And they've turned it into a repeat. In that way, it's slightly different. And they've coloured it for today.
Some really bright, vivid colours.
Yeah, but also cool colours. So they've sort of done the same thing that he's done. We're now looking at a design that was first designed in the late 19th century. And it was very famous. And I'm showing you a silk from the 1960s.
Does it have a name, this one?
Clementina. And in the 1960s, Liberty was one of the very first firms to revive Art Nouveau, which was deeply unfashionable in the 1950s. And they brought out a collection in 1960, which is very early, using their Art Nouveau designs from their archive. And I don't know if you know, but Art Nouveau is the word that we understand. In Italy, it's called Liberty.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it from?
From the shop, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. And you can see this is a very 60s version of it, but it was the original design was quite big as well. And what they've done is they've brought it right down in scale, again, slightly altered, certainly different colouring, to make it into something that is very usable today.
And where does the actual manufacturing take place?
Well, actually, all our fabrics are now printed in Italy. We have our own print works there now.
Where exactly? Which region?
Como. This is a silk pattern book from around about 1905. You can see how important colour is when you look through these. So these are block prints from Liberty's own print works at the time. I mean, 1905 this is.
It's amazing.
Isn't it? It looks like 1960s. Yeah. I mean, look at that. Isn't that wonderful? And Liberty was famous for having these Indian gauzes hanging in their windows in sort of gradating colours just like this. So it's a wonderful little snapshot of the business at that time.
Is there anything about Liberty himself that might not be well known that you think is worth highlighting about his life and what he did?
He started off as a salesman. He knew what it was like not to have any money and to work for another employer. And he was very good to his employees. And I have here a certificate that's absolutely beautifully written, handwritten, from his employees thanking him for instituting half-day closing on Saturday.
And every one of them has signed it?
Yeah.
That's really beautiful. Why do you think that these designs have lasted and really stood the test of time?
Because they're beautiful. One of the things that Liberty was always famous for was the colouring, and that's still taken very seriously. And they're beautifully printed, and it is the quality of the design and the quality of the print that makes them last.
That was our producer, Daphne Karnesis, at the Textile Archive of Liberty Department Store, right here in London. On next week's show, we ask why go to architecture school and wonder about the future of these august institutions. We do our homework by hosting a special roundtable with the women at the helm of two of the world's finest, the Architectural Association here in London and Columbia University's School of Architecture in New York, to find out a little more. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.